To the Clean and Filthy Podcast with your host, Matthew M.
Hello, and welcome to the Clean and Filthy Podcast, where we are clean and serene with a filthy mind in between. I am your host. My name is Matthew M., and I am an addict. Very, very excited to be back with another episode. We are on episode 4. So a huge shout out to everybody for being here, hanging out with us. Thank you so much. Before we go any further, I have to give a huge shout out to our two episode sponsors for this episode. First off, we have Etc. by Emily. So if you have any interest or need for staffing for an event or a party, or if you're looking for a job, check out Etc. by Emily. All the information is in the description below, as well as Metaphysical Minds. Thank you again for sponsoring us. They are a brand new company specializing in crystals and sage and all kinds of other spiritual type of thing. So if you're interested in them, check them out in the description below. Again, thank you everybody for all of the continued support, helping us grow both by watching us here live on YouTube every single Tuesday at 5 p.m. Arizona time, and also from everybody continuing to download the podcast wherever you consume your podcasts from. We are listed on all different podcast directories. So please, even if you're watching this live, we really ask that you go to wherever you consume your podcast from. Search for Clean and Filthy, one word, podcast, and give us a download. We really appreciate it. That's how we're going to really grow, because we love doing this live here on YouTube. But the way that we're really going to grow and be able to help more people is by being out there and getting downloads. The higher our downloads go, the higher we go up on podcast directories. So thank you very much for doing that. Again, you know, it only takes a couple seconds and it helps us immensely. So if you're listening to this on one of those podcast directories, thank you for the download. Hopefully you hear something you like and you come back and check us out again. If you want to partake in the live stream, head on over to youtube.com, search for Clean and Filthy Podcast, and join us there. We do the live stream at 5 p.m. every single Tuesday. It's fun. We get a big group of people all hanging out in the chat. And it's a lot of fun for me to go back and rewatch the chat at the end. So however you want to support us, we appreciate it greatly. Of course, you can get all the information for all of our social media links by simply going to www.cleanandfilthypodcast.com. And in the top right corner, we have all of our different social media links that you can like, follow, subscribe, share, anything that your heart desires, just to help us grow and, you know, help us become a successful product that really carries the message of recovery and helps people out there. Before we get into anything further, we got to give a huge shout out to our VIP supporters. These are people on Patreon who have pledged a donation of at least $5 to help grow this podcast. So a huge shout out to Char, Clint, Andrea, and Alex. And if you are interested in becoming one of our VIP supporters, please head over to Patreon. That link is also on the website, right up at the top next to all the social media links. And for everybody who contributes, you get one of these awesome Clean and Filthy podcast stickers sent over to you. Again, that's a great way for us to be able to invest back in this product. And way that we did that most recently is we have a brand new microphone. So shout out to Rode for this awesome microphone. I can't say shout out to them because I bought it. But hey, if you guys want to sponsor me and want to send me some products, I would not be mad at that at all. So thank you for having a good product for a moderate price that hopefully is carrying my voice at a more wonderful tone for the listeners, hopefully. I don't know. I like it regardless. So if you guys don't, whatever. I still like it and I feel good about it. So again, huge shout out to our VIP supporters. And also, if you are a VIP supporter, you will have first access when we start producing Clean and Filthy podcast merchandise. We are going to be looking into doing some shirts, some hats, I don't know, maybe some coffee mugs. I'm willing to brand this on whatever and everything. So everybody who is a supporter gets first opportunity to purchase merchandise and help continue supporting this podcast. So that is all on the website. And again, thank you so much for all of our VIP contributors. So I apologize, anybody who's watching this live. The vibe is a little off. I'm usually more centered. And yeah, the whole thing is very off currently. Because I have to keep my foot elevated. I really wish I had an amazing story, but all I can say is that I had a very unfortunate disc golfing accident. I wanted to come up with something so much better than that. I wanted to come up with something like that was just awesome as to why, you know, like I rescued a school bus full of children from like a fiery inferno and sprained my ankle. But that's not the case, and I work an honest program just for today. So I have to admit that that this was an unfortunate disc golfing incident, which probably is the least awesome injury I could ever have, to be quite honest. Like, I've played sports most of my life, and I've definitely had some injuries. And all of them had a better story than this one. I will say, if you are ever at the Papago disc golf course, and you just so happen to make a horrible shot on the third hole and it goes down into the ravine and you see what looks like a very stable log to cross said ravine, unlike the other logs that are stable, that one is not stable. And of course, me channeling my inner Spider-Man and, you know, thinking I'm athletic and no issue, I decided to jump down off of the side of the ravine onto the log, and the log was not stable. And in the span of 0.1 millisecond, my ankle was savagely attacked by a large piece of rock, and I sliced up a bunch of other stuff, and it was very humbling, I gotta say. And I am pleased to announce that thanks to having it raised in ice, it is no longer looking like a baseball on the side of my ankle and now is simply turning into a blue large expanse of fluid from the top of my foot to my heel. So I apologize if anybody's OCD is kind of messing up because I'm not centered in the middle of my logo there. But you know, we continue. We press on. Even a sprained ankle ain't gonna keep us from pressing on, because we here every week, no matter what. Pandemics, sprained ankles, life on life's terms. Yeah. So, thank you, everybody. That is the reasoning. Hopefully, we'll be back to normal next week. I really hope so, but we'll see what happens. So, before we get into our first segment, I'm actually doing it in order this time. We have to make sure to mention, you know, what we do here at the Clean and Filthy Podcast and also what we don't do. So again, this is a podcast about 12-step recovery, but I will not be at any point endorsing, speaking for, recommending, or anything else regarding a specific 12-step fellowship. I want to make sure that I stay in line with the traditions. I want to make sure that I protect, you know, the sanctity of the traditions, because it is something that is very important to me, and keep that level of anonymity when it comes to press, radio, and films, which I guess this is press and radio and film as well. So it's a trifecta there. So we are not speaking for any specific type of fellowship. I'm not telling you that you need to go to this fellowship and this is the way it works. All I'm doing is sharing my experience, strength, and hope, and, you know, some of my opinion as to what has worked for me in my recovery. Now, if you're new and you want information about a fellowship or how to get to a meeting or how to find a recovery residence or a sober living, or you just don't get it, please reach out to me directly. You can send me an email at Matthew@cleanandfilthypodcast.com or contact me on any social media, because I want to be able to help, but I want to be able to make sure I stay in line with the traditions while doing so. I want to make sure that I'm not, you know, speaking as a person of authority for anything outside of what has worked for myself. So I'm not speaking as a point of endorsement for any treatment centers, sober livings, specific fellowships, none of that. All I'm doing is giving information to try and help somebody understand a little bit more about 12-step recovery, whatever fellowship it is. This is simply, you know, the purpose of this is for us to be able to create a community and create a chance for people who, you know, maybe are curious about recovery, maybe have no contact with addiction at all, but are curious about it. This is for people who, you know, maybe you are an addict in recovery, or maybe you're an addict who's not in recovery and you just need information, or you just want to hang out. That's what we're here for. We just want to be a resource for people in recovery or for people who have questions about recovery. Because at the end of the day, every single person in this world knows somebody or has been affected by addiction in some form, even if they don't know it, honestly. So that is why we are here. We are not speaking for any specific fellowship or anything like that. I just want to make sure that is very clear. And I actually did it in order today, so hooray for that. So now that we got that little wrap up in there, let's get into our first segment.
Let's head to the lab for some R&D. Recovery and development.
That is right. We are in the lab for some R&D. This is the segment of the show where each week we go through one of the steps, traditions, concepts, or spiritual principles that are within 12-step recovery. And we discuss how they affect recovery, our lives, living life on life's terms, all of those things. And again, if you aren't in recovery, that's perfectly fine, because the beautiful thing, as I always say about recovery, is that it doesn't have to do just with drugs. It has to do with the things that we feel inside of us, the obsession, the compulsion, the complete self-centeredness. And that goes a lot deeper than just drugs. So if you're sitting here thinking, I'm not an addict, why am I going to listen to this? Well, you know, I you know, suggest maybe stick around. Maybe you'll hear something that will make something a little more clear for you. And if not, well, thank you for the support anyway, and hope to see you next week. So we are on week 4. And that means we are on step 4. Ooh. It's funny. This step has such a negative connotation when you first come into the rooms. And it's really weird because, you know, everybody says, oh, step 4, it's so scary, it's the worst step. But honestly, in my little over 3 years in recovery, I've only met one person who actually said that the fourth step was scary or they hated the fourth step. I've heard a lot of people say that they've heard the fourth step is scary or horrible. But one person of all the addicts that I've met and talked to and whatever, since I came into recovery, who actually said I hated the fourth step. So it's funny because it gets this huge negative connotation, like, oh my God, fourth step, it's so scary, it's so scary. But for me personally, the fourth step is actually one of the most freeing, beautiful things that I've ever worked through in my recovery. So the fourth step says, we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. All right, so we're going internal on this one, right? This is going to be some internal stuff. So the first three steps are really the setup type of steps, and they are so massively important to actually be able to honestly do a fourth step. You know, we have to have that honesty in the first step, that admission. Then in the second step, we got to build some hope. We got to get a contact with some type of higher power. We need to feel something. And then the third step, we need to have that trust that our higher power has our back, right? And that is one of the most important things when it comes to the fourth step. I know for a fact working a fourth step without having a higher power, without having conscious contact with that higher power, without belief that I was living in my higher power's will and it had my back, fourth step wouldn't have been possible. Because it's a very deep process. You know, the we say in the literature that steps 4 through 9 is like the process inside of the process. And that's so true. That's so true, because this is where we get into the nitty-gritty, the internal, you know, stuff. This is where, you know, we talk about this is like cutting an onion, right? This is like peeling back the onion. The first three steps are peeling back the onion. Now this is like the onion inside of the onion, where we really need to peel it back and we really need to start looking at our motivations and our reasonings and our justifications and just the way that we react to situations. And that's what the fourth step does. The most beautiful thing for me within the fourth step is that it truly helped me find out who I was, really so I could like and accept myself. And I will say, thankfully, by the time I got to my fourth step, there wasn't a lot of element of self-acceptance within myself and my recovery. So I didn't have a lot of fear. You know, the thing that was interesting to me is it's like people were talking about fear, like, oh, no, you know, like writing these things down that we've done somehow makes them more real when we've already done them. We've already done them. And if you have a belief in a higher power, your higher power already knows about it. So this fear that somehow by writing it down, we're going to become, you know, this evil collection of our actions. It's a very weird thing, but it's something that is so prevalent. You know, there's so much fear going into a fourth step. For the majority of people that I've, you know, worked a fourth step with, a majority of sponsees who've worked a fourth step, there's that element of fear. Very few come in and just say, look, here you go. And I will say that was what I did. And, you know, before we even get into that, we got to talk about, first, most important is have a conscious contact with the higher power. Because then that helps turn that fear into faith, right? Second most important thing, you got to have a sponsor. Do not work a fourth step. Don't work any step without a sponsor. That's my suggestion. I'm not going to tell you what to do, but don't work a fourth step or any step without a sponsor. Suggestion. Not telling. Suggestion. Just a suggestion. But listen to that suggestion, please.
That part.
So get a sponsor that you feel comfortable with. Get a sponsor that you don't feel fear regarding. And thankfully, my sponsor, when my sponsor that I worked my fourth step with, that I worked my first full round of steps with, he had quite a vibe to him. I'm not going to get into the exact details. I don't want to break any anonymity. But I first met him when he was sharing for, I believe, he had 14 or 15 years. And I identified with him when he made a comment in his share that he understands what everybody's going through. He's been there with the puddle water and all the dicks. And when he said that, there was just something about it that was like, wow, I know I'm a sick fuck. And this dude just shared that honestly and openly. This guy's going to work. So from the jump, I felt a level of connection and a level of comfortability when I would say things to him, when I would tell him things, when I would go over, you know, previous parts of my step work. Because I didn't feel judgment. I didn't feel, you know, some level of concern about what I was about to say. Because when we first come in, you know, we have that fear of what if our deepest secrets are found out? Not just by the fellowship, but by the public. What if everybody knows what I did that one time when I was this or that? And that fear about how people are going to accept us keeps us living in sickness. You know, that's why we talk about secrets keep us sick. And that's why we talk about that need to let go of something that we're carrying inside of us. And so thankfully, you know, I had such a good vibe with my sponsor. I knew that whatever I told him, he wasn't going to tell anybody else. And guess what? Most of the stuff I told him, he said, yeah, me too. Which that phrase in itself is such a feeling of unity. Because when we come in the rooms, we talked about this before, everybody, we all think we're special. Nobody was as bad as I was. Nobody was. I was the worst ever. Well, guess what? If you come into any room of any fellowship, there's going to be somebody in there who has done the same stuff that you have. That's going to have experienced the same stuff that you have. It's going to have walked through the same issues of life on life's term that you have. Whether it be trauma, whether it be guilt, whether it be shame, whatever it is, at the end of the day, everybody's gone through it because we really aren't that different. We truly aren't. We are all human beings, no matter what our background is. And maybe it's not your sponsor who walked through that situation. Or maybe it's not, you know, your best friend. Or maybe it's just somebody you don't even know. But if you really want to get that level of identification, there will be somebody within the fellowship who has gone through that same situation and will say those words of me too. I know I've worked, when I was working step work with one of my sponsees back in the day, he was doing his fourth step and he said some things that I could tell he had so much consternation about. He had so much fear about it. He had shame about it. And as soon as he got to tell me, I'm like, bruh. Me too. What's and like you're good. And immediately I saw a level of relief just like wash over him in that moment. And I could tell that then as he went through the rest of his fourth step, that fear had turned into faith. That fear had turned into realization that guess what? I just shared something that's like a deepest, darkest thing with this person. And they said, me too. So we're on even playing field here. Because nobody in any fellowship is better than or less than anybody. Even if we haven't gone through the same situations or the same experiences, nobody's better or less than anybody else. So that's when we say fearless moral inventory. That means having the courage to be honest, even when we're cringing inside and swearing that we'll take what we're writing to the grave. Everybody's got those. Everybody's got those graveyard things filed away deep up in the closet. They're in the closet inside of the closet that's inside of the panic room that's like cemented under the floorboards. Everybody's got those. Everybody does. But no matter what yours are, somebody has experienced it. Somebody has gone through that. And it might not be your sponsor, but that doesn't mean that you shouldn't tell your sponsor. Also, if you aren't comfortable with that, it doesn't mean it has to be your sponsor. You know, it says in our literature that we don't have to tell our fourth step to our sponsor. It could be to anybody. It could be to a stranger. Personally, my fourth step, I'm glad I didn't tell a stranger because I would have, if I'm not already on a bunch of watch lists, which I probably am, hi, Larry at the NSA. I just call him Larry because he's always lurking. I guarantee I would have been on some watch lists after my fourth step. It's just how it is. That's my reality. That's my reality. That's my past. But my past actions don't define who I am. I'm not a collection of the fucked up shit I've done. I'm not that person. Especially now that I'm in recovery. Especially now that I made a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. The fact that I told my sponsor, strap in, bruh, we're going places. And proceeded to lay out, was like 220 answers worth of stuff. And I didn't feel like he was judging me. There were a couple parts that I took an extra big gulp. At this point, I was still vaping, so I think I went through about half of a tank, you know, before I got to that, before I got to that part. But when I went through it, I got freedom. I got serenity. I got peace. I got peace realizing that it was okay, that I was no longer being kept sick by my secrets. So again, we have to be able to turn that fear, because fear is such an underlying part of the fourth step. I think that's why so many people, you know, have heard, quote unquote, somebody say the fourth step's the scariest step or the worst step. Because there's that fear. There's that fear of acknowledging what's inside of us. There's that fear. And I agree. When you write it down, it does become more real. Even though it shouldn't, because it's already happened. But it's kind of like, you know, if I don't put this down, then maybe I can live in denial. Well, denial is what keeps us sick as addicts. Denial is what keeps us living in disease instead of living in recovery. Now, again, I will say, a fourth step is a very personal thing. You know, there are things on my fourth step that I damn sure, no chance in hell, am going to be sharing in an open meeting. Even not in a men's meeting. There are things within my fourth step that are very, very personal to myself and my recovery, to where the only people that know it is my sponsor or maybe somebody else. I mean, I can't think of specific examples, but they're not things that I just go and share with the world. Not because I'm not in self-acceptance of them, but because it's not necessary. You know, it's not necessary to put those things out there for mass consumption. It's just how it is. And that's why having that faith in a higher power, having that trust with a sponsor to truly trust, good alliteration, that they're not going to broadcast your business. And that doesn't mean that it doesn't happen. So again, we are human. And that doesn't mean, I've heard horror stories of somebody, you know, sponsor mentioning parts of somebody else's fourth step. And that's not okay. And whoever did that probably needs to work on some spiritual principles. Because our fourth step and our inventory is written for us. We aren't taking anybody else's inventory. We aren't judging anybody else. And we aren't even judging ourselves. That's the beautiful thing of the fourth step, is it allows us to free ourselves from the judgment that very often leads to shame and guilt. But within that, you know, like I said, secrets keep us sick. So being able to unlock parts of our subconscious that remain hidden, and that happens so often when we start writing. When we start writing and we start putting things down and our experiences down, other things will pop up that maybe we didn't even remember. Maybe it wasn't even something that we thought of at the time. You know, it wasn't something that was renting space in our brain. But once we start opening up that panic room underneath the closet and the closet under the cement floor, things start coming up. And a lot of times, it can be well after you've worked a fourth step that something will pop up. You're like, wow. Beautiful thing about this program is we don't ever stop working steps. So the next fourth step, we get to deal with whatever that thing is that popped up. And that is such a freedom. There's such a freedom within being able to walk through things that have happened in our past. There's such a freedom to being able to acknowledging what's happened in the past. And for me, the most important part within that is being able to see my part and take responsibility for my part. That's why most of the time, when we go over our resentments that are on our fourth step, those will be people or institutions or whatever that we will address on our eighth and ninth step and we make amends to. Very often, there are some exceptions, but for the most part, if something's on your fourth step, you'll probably address it again as you go further. But that freedom of being able to just say, wow, this action occurred. This is my part of it. I can take responsibility for what occurred. I no longer have to justify or rationalize or manipulate my brain into thinking that I was completely, you know, a victim in a situation that I was equally at fault for. And that's such a great feeling. It can be a painful feeling. It can be an icky feeling. It can feel difficult. But being able to walk through that is such a opportunity for freedom. You know, and it says that the fourth step is not a confession of how bad We are. It's not. But it is an opportunity to free ourselves from the past, not cling to it. This isn't, you know, the fourth step can be scary when people think like, oh, all this is just going to be, you know, all these questions about how big of a piece of shit I was and all of the fucked up things I did and how horrible I was as a human being. That's not the case. Because again, our actions do not dictate who we are, especially our actions in active addiction. That's just the facts. The things we do speak to living in disease as opposed, you know, when if they're fucked up things, as opposed to living in recovery. So it's a very healthy, cleansing type of thing. It really is. And it takes a while. You know, there are a lot of different ways that you work a four step, depending on what fellowship you're in, depending on how your sponsor set it up. I mean, there are all kinds of different ways. But one thing I will say personally is that it took some time. It took some diligent effort. Like I said, mine was like over 220 total questions. I had a lot of resentments, and there are a lot of questions that I had to respond to for each one of those resentments. But don't be scared about that. You know, one of the worst things that we can do is sit on a fourth step. One of the worst things we can do, I've heard so many stories about people who are so scared of a fourth step, are so full of fear that they never do one. And it says in our literature that a fourth step is required for ongoing recovery because it's where we learn so much. We see patterns. We take responsibility. We realize that we're not as bad or as great as we thought we were. We start to develop some humility that we get into a lot more in the seventh step. We build off of that honesty. We build off of that faith. And it's truly, like, the fourth step is such a combination of so many spiritual principles, depending on which part you're on. It's one of the greatest things I've done in my life, not just in my recovery. It's one of the greatest things that I've done, and the feeling that I was able to work through within it. And even being able to understand, even being able to acknowledge the feelings, because so much of my active addiction wasn't looking at feelings. Or if it was the 100% extreme on either side. This gives us the opportunity to look at the patterns that we've done in the past. Look at the things that came up from our past. And find what works and leave the rest. You know, it says in the literature that the fourth step is like a pressure release valve. And it allows us to no longer stew in that Instapot that you've got cooking of all that shame and guilt and issues and problems and ickiness. And it allows us to just relieve that pressure. And that's truly what it does. So for me, it's one of the most freeing things there is. Really, it truly is. So I want to go, we're not getting super deep into the fourth step today because there's so many things within it. I just want to give kind of a basic overview, basic understanding of it. But one of the things that always is said is that you can never write too much. You can definitely write too little. And that could be scary, like when we're about to write into certain sections, because there's sections in here that can be woo. But when we can reaffirm our connection with a higher power, it becomes so much easier. So some of the things that we get into, and we're going to go back and do another episode on the fourth step and actually kind of dive into each one of these topics a little bit more and kind of, you know, discuss how it relates to recovery overall. But we talk about resentments. Resentments is the first thing. We talk about relationships. We talk about feelings and how we responded or reacted to feelings, if we could even acknowledge them. We talk about guilt and shame, something we're going to talk about a little bit later in this program. We talk about fear. You know, that's something that came up so much within my fourth step, was a fear of failure and a fear of success, which helped me when it came time for my sixth step. We talk about sex and the lack of healthy sexuality, something that was my entire sexual life was not living in healthy sexuality. Definitely something we're going to get into talking a lot more about. We talk about abuse. Because it's so common that having abuse and trauma is a gateway within to addiction. You know, that's something that we do when something occurs that we don't know how to process what it brings up inside of us. We turn to an escape. That's something that's so common. Then we have talk about secrets. Like I said, secrets keep us sick. We got to let those go. We got to shine light on it. And then the last part that we talk about is assets. And that's what's so often forgotten about within the four steps. Everybody thinks, oh my God, this is just, you know, page after page after page of everything awful and horrible. But we end it with assets. Again, we are not as bad or as great as we think we are. We are somewhere in the middle. And that honest approximation of who we are speaks to humility. So again, that's something that we're going to get into each one of those a lot more on a future episode. The four steps, just way too much. There's way too much to go over on that. But like I said before, the beautiful thing about it is that we can use it as a kind of a map so that we can review our past and our present behaviors to see what we want to keep and what we want to get rid of, which gives us that clarity, not just for the sixth step, but then also within to the eighth and ninth step. And one of the things that I know I said it earlier, but when I say that I know that I am not my actions do not define me as a human being. That's something that I really clung to, especially when writing an honest fourth step. Because I know that whatever it is that I'm saying, whatever I did in my past doesn't define who I am. And the last thing I want to say about the fourth step, the last thing, is that we write our fourth step as though there is no fifth step. And that's very difficult to do. I mean, come on. We're human beings with consciousness. We know that we're writing this fourth step to end up telling another human being. It says it in the fifth step, which we'll get to next week. So it's difficult to do that. Just like they say, write your eighth step like there's no ninth step. Okay, well, that's all great. But it's much more difficult to detach that element, I have found. But it gets easier when we turn and rely on our higher power. It gets easier when we can take those scary moments, those scary hours, quote a Drake album there, and realize that we're not doing it alone. Realize that anything we're going to say technically is already been said within the world, and it's already been known within my personal, you know, story, maybe not by another human being, but by something. So why do I need to have fear? A loving and caring higher power, and my trust in that higher power tells me that I don't have to live in fear within that. Not saying it always happens, but I don't have to, which is a beautifully freeing thing. So if you're sitting there on a fourth step and you don't want to put pen to paper, I get it. I understand it. But I can tell you from my experience, strength, and hope that it was one of the most freeing things that I could ever do within my recovery. And it's something that I love working a fourth step with a sponsee, partly because it's kind of a landmark thing because I've sponsored a lot of guys, especially straight out of treatment. And so I've done the 1-2-3 shuffle with a lot of people. That's what they say when you work your first three steps and then disappear or go to a new sponsor and do 1-2-3 again because you don't want to work on that fourth step. But because I've sponsored a lot of guys who were in treatment, you know, about that amount of time, you know, they're in for 60 to 90 days. Cool. They work their first three steps. And then I don't hear from them again. They get out of treatment and they disappear. So when I get to work a fourth step with somebody, it's such a great feeling because it shows a commitment to recovery. It shows a commitment to ourselves. It shows a commitment to want to be a better person. You know, for me, that's where it really, like, where the rubber really meets the road within recovery. The first three steps, massively important to be able to set up this next chunk of recovery. But real recovery, for me, truly starts with that work on that fourth step. You know, that was the beginning of this journey to truly become a better human being that I, you know, work at every single day to the best of my ability. So if you're sitting on a four-step, I suggest you put in some work on that four-step. Just a suggestion. You don't have to listen to me, but just a suggestion, because the freedom that I have felt from it was absolutely incredible.
That part.
All right, so that was what we had for R&D today. Join us next week as we get into the fifth step. But now it's time for my favorite moment of the week. So there were some things that popped off that I really, you know, wanted to talk about. One of them being WandaVision. I know there's a couple people out there listening right now who are screaming yes, but we're not going to talk about that today. For one thing, because I don't want to spoiler alert it for anybody. And for another thing, even though I could talk about it for the better part of a couple hours, there's some people out there who probably don't care about WandaVision or Marvel in general. That might be the vibe. At some point, I might have to reach out to Alex. Yeah, brother. We might need to do a Marvel podcast. I'm just saying. So I wanted to talk about that. I also wanted to, one of my favorite things the last few days on Instagram has been all of the memes that have come up post Prince Harry and Meghan Markle's interview with Oprah. There have been some fire memes, straight hardcore memeage from that. But, you know, I still didn't even watch the interview, so I don't feel like that's something I could really discuss. Also, shout out to the NBA All-Star Game. Did the best they could with what they had. Wasn't great. Entertaining, though. Watching Dame Dalla and Steph chefing it up from half court was incredibly entertaining, I gotta say. So, it was worth a watch. I probably wouldn't have watched it. I was actually planning on being disc golfing, but my ankle dictated that I got to watch it. So, hooray for that. But what I want to talk about, and I need to mention a little bit of a trigger warning here. We're going to be talking about some gambling. So if you're a gambling addict or you struggle with compulsive gambling, I'm just letting you know right now that this is something that might be a little triggering. But I was able to see one of the days, just had ESPN on, a re-showing of the World Series of Poker 2020. And, you know, it was very interesting for me because, like, I'm going to get a little bit more into my background, but I always have been interested in watching the World Series of Poker. That's something that's always been a big part of my identity, was playing poker. And I'm going to get into the background of it. But I didn't know that they were even, you know, because of COVID, I didn't know that they were actually going to have a main event. And so when I saw it just randomly come up on ESPN, I was quite happy. And it was cool because they did the best they could with what they had. They made it like a virtual event for the first part, and they had an American champion playing a European champion. And so shout out to Joseph Herbert, who won the American side of it. Shout out to Damian Salas, who after this was his second main event final table that he made, and this time he won it. It was an amazing six-hour back-and-forth battle, whatever, whatever. And it was crazy because I haven't been involved in poker in a while. But it used to be my everything. You know, it used to be the most important thing in my life when I was 20, 21, 22, 23. It was really all I thought about in a lot of ways. It was the thing that I was most concerned with, if you will. You know, it was my hobby that I was trying to turn into more than a hobby. You know, I went through the days of just playing randomly like garbage every, you know, week or two to then actually running a game at my house. I actually ran a World Series of Poker like qualifier event. It was called the Imperial Poker Tour. Shout out to the IPT. We had a lot of fun those days. I had a poker room in my old house, and we would get, you know, 20 guys and women. Sorry, not to be sexist there. Apologize. And would have great times. And at the end of it, you know, I started off just playing for fun when there would be a big UFC fight or, you know, something like that. And then it kept growing and it kept growing and it kept growing until finally we were doing a World Series of Poker qualifier. And we would all put in a certain amount of money, and we would play over a certain amount of time. And whoever won got to go to Vegas for the World Series of Poker. And even before I started doing that, I had traveled to Vegas a couple different times, specifically for the World Series of Poker, to go to the just the spectacle that is the World Series. When you go there to the Rio, and it's an entire just massive ocean of humanity, and the sound of chips clinking together. Oh my God, that's one of my favorite sounds. Like not quite to the level of like V12 Lamborghini with straight pipes on it, but like it's one of them. It's one of like my top 5 to 7 favorite sounds. Just all those chips just grink, being shuffled together. Grink. Oh, I love that. Love that. Like that could be like ASMR type stuff. That could be like how I fall asleep. I don't need to hear the ocean. Just let me hear. I'm sure most of the people out there do not get what I'm saying. But if you're a poker player, you probably do. So I'd started back in the day, you know, playing somewhat competitively just for fun. It was really for fun. Then I started reading. Oh, I started reading every poker book I could get my hands on. And then got involved with some online poker and was never that great. You know, it was a very humbling thing. Even though I didn't realize it in that moment, I felt, you know, I was a lot better than I actually was. And lost some money here, won some money there, lost some money here, whatever. Cool, cool, cool. But every year we would go to the World Series of Poker. That's actually the first time I ever got interviewed by any kind of anything was at the World Series of Poker because I was video blogging. This is like way back in the day. Like there are videos out there on YouTube. I can't give you the name on air because I don't want to therefore say my last name because it's my first name, my last name, and the word poker. Got tons of videos on YouTube. They're trash, for the record. No production value at all. It was literally me with a handheld camera, like doing this type of a thing. Just video blogging and doing poker recaps and shoe reviews and all these other things that, you know, I was trying to develop as a path for life. Because that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a poker player. That was it. Period. I'm working at a bank at this time. And I just wanted to be a poker player. And so I did everything I could. I was trying to build this following. Without, you know, any production value or YouTube quality or anything like that. But that's what I wanted to do. And it's crazy because it really speaks to the level of powerlessness that I didn't even understand. But that was the thing I wanted to do more than anything. But my addiction got in the way. That was the thing I wanted to do more than anything else. And I loved more than anything else. The goal in life was to win a World Series bracelet, buy a Lamborghini. Let's go. That was the goal. And I will say those are very short-sighted goals, but you know, give me a little bit of I don't know, credit or slack. I mean, sorry, cut me a little slack the fact that I was, you know, early 20s thinking that all that mattered was money and women and at that point drugs. You know, now actually looking at what life is and being able to help wasn't a thought. And I will say there were times I was like, yo, if I win that main event, that's like 10 milli. Cool. I'll like donate some money. But, you know, those were the views I had. And so, you know, it became a yearly thing. We would go to the World Series and I loved it. I would stay there for a week and I would just have fun and just be in the element and play an event or two when I could. When I hadn't spent all my money on dope. And even just like the element of like going and hanging out at the strip club afterwards. And like all these things that were like such stereotypical like 20-year-old, you know, mid-20s type of dude type of things. You know, like I look back on it, I'm like, okay, bro. Like, yeah, well, there's that. But that's where I was at in my life. Those are the things that seemed important. And I even, things lined up. Things lined up very well. After I, you know, played in the World Series, I played in the Arizona State Poker Tour, or Poker Championship, sorry. You know, I was playing online and making decent money. Not enough to, like, support myself, but making, you know, decent little side income. And then I actually had a really moderate cash. I took third place in a World Series of Poker circuit event at the Caesars Palace Hotel, which they don't even have a poker room anymore. It's so sad. But it was one of the greatest experiences of my life because for once I felt like, okay, I'm actually good enough at something. And what I love about poker is that it's like a game of chess every single hand. And the beautiful thing about poker is it's the only type of thing, and I'm not going to call it a sport because I don't want to get into that whole debate. And then we got to start talking about esports, and I'm not trying to get into all that. But it's the one thing in life where I can go out and compete with somebody and could potentially beat them. I could compete with the best people in the world, and I could potentially win. If I try to go and play basketball against LeBron James, I'm not going to win. I'm just not. If I try to go play tennis with Serena Williams, I'm not going to win. I'm just not. Throw me in a car racing after Lewis Hamilton, I'll be happy if I'm not lapped 50 times. But in poker, I can go and sit at a table with somebody else who's the best in the world and maybe, just maybe, could beat them. Probably not, because contrary to what most people think, poker isn't gambling. Poker is a game of skill. It's not a game of luck, though there is luck involved. But that's one of the things I always loved about it. And so my game had gotten better, and I made it to this final table, and it was cool. I got interviewed for WSOP.com and played incredibly well, whatever, whatever. Semantics of it, I got out, knocked down third place. Made one major mistake, got knocked down third place, but had a good cash, a four-figure cash, if you will. And I said, that right there shows that I don't need to be using opiates. I don't need to be using opiates to play poker, because in my mind, I did. The first time I ever used an opiate was driving on my way to the World Series of Poker with two of my buddies. Mark, you know who. That was the first time I ever used one. And then it became the standard that I needed opiates to play poker. And it also kind of was, that's just what we did. We did opiates and we played poker. So subconsciously, there was probably that element. But in that weekend, I didn't use any opiates and I was able to take third place. So I told myself, hey, look, I don't need opiates. I have willpower. I'm going to dedicate myself to poker. That lasted a week and I was back using opiates. Because no matter what, I'm powerless over my addiction. Something that I love more than anything else at that time wasn't enough to keep me from using. But I tried it again. I tried it again because I moved to Las Vegas. Things lined up to where I moved to Vegas. I moved to Vegas to be a poker player. That's what I did. That's why I moved there. And I wasn't going to use opiates. I'm not going to use opiates. I don't need them because I'm going to be a poker pro. Lasted 8 days. 8 days, and I was back using opiates. And I can truly say that I played less poker in Vegas, living in Vegas to be a poker player, than I did living in Arizona, where it was just something that we did for funsies. Because my life was controlled. My disease had progressed to where instead of it being like, oh, hey, maybe I'll go get some drugs after I've played poker, it became, oh, hey, maybe I'll go play some poker after I've got my drugs. I was so controlled to that level. Something that was my favorite thing, if you will. My favorite thing. But it wasn't as important to me as drugs. And that was one of the amends I had to make. I had to clean that up because I moved in with a guy for the sole purpose of being a poker player. That was the sole purpose. But playing poker got in the way of my using career. And that was something that I had to clean up of my wreckage. And we'll get to that when we get to the eighth and ninth step. But one of the biggest things that I felt that I was able to walk through on my fourth step was this feeling of shame and guilt, to the point that I was in Vegas for about three-ish years, okay? I moved back, and mind you, my disease was just, I was trying new substances and new ways and other substances and combination of substances, and it got to the point where I had to move back. All I was doing, essentially, was I don't want to implicate myself in any potential felony. I don't know what the statute of limitation is for selling of drugs, so I'm not going to get into that. But I was making trips back and forth to Arizona and would get enough money in Arizona to come back to Vegas and survive for a month. And at one point, it just didn't become feasible from a monetary standpoint, so I just stayed in Arizona. But I felt such shame about that. I felt such shame about the fact that I didn't give myself a chance. Because I really believed, and I still honestly do, that I was good enough to have maybe made it. I'm not saying I'd be sitting, you know, in the Panorama Towers playing poker with Dan Bilzerian or something. But I feel like I could have actually succeeded to a level better than I did. And I felt so much shame about that. To the point that when I came back to Arizona, I didn't even tell anybody I was back. And also I was highly involved in substances that were making me not really want to be around anybody. But it was definitely, there was definitely that shame element. And I knew there was. And I knew I felt something. Like when one of my friends would write and be like, hey, how's Vegas? And I've been back in Arizona for 8 months. I just wouldn't respond. But by working a four-step and discussing the resentment that I felt towards myself because of that, discussing the shame that I felt regarding that, I was able to walk free of it. And I gotta say, like, while watching this event, it made me think back to sitting there watching the final table for hours and the excitement of it. The excitement of it was something that I haven't felt for a hobby or for a thing other than, you know, recovery, honestly. And I still didn't feel to that level, but there's definitely something there. And so I want to go play poker more. But this is where we get into an issue with my therapist, because my therapist specializes in gambling addiction. So when we've talked before about how I want to play poker, she is very hesitant about that, because what if, you know? And I always say, well, look, I've compulsively gambled before. I will admit that. I have lost a lot of money chasing a run at roulette or a run at craps or run at blackjack. That was incredibly compulsive. I've spent money I shouldn't have spent. But I've never done it at poker, because to me, poker was always about a game of skill. It was always about using my knowledge to play as well as I could. And honestly, if I was playing well, even if I got unlucky and I lost, I still felt okay about it. That's what's weird for me with poker. It's like, even if I got unlucky and lost money, I wasn't mad about it. I was only mad about it when I didn't play well. When I didn't play well and I made a mistake, that's when I would get pissed. But so this element of compulsive gambling is something that her and I will probably have to have more of a conversation about. Because at some point, I want to go back to playing poker. Maybe not, you know, to the levels I was. I'm not saying I'm going to be running a game here in my condo. But it's something that I really enjoy. And it's a way that I can kind of flex my brain at times. And I like doing that. That's why I like chess. That's why I like learning. That's why I like recovery. Because I get to grow within it. But the thing that she says, and I can relate this back to regular to drug-related recovery so quickly, is that just because I've never had a problem with it in the past doesn't mean I won't in the future. And that's why within, you know, the disease of addiction, it doesn't matter what the substance is. Because just because I've never had a problem with, you know, drinking or with smoking weed or whatever in the past doesn't mean that I won't in the future. Because I'm not that same person. I'm not the same person that I was. And that could mean that I would never have a problem with it. Or it could mean that my disease is looking for a new way to manifest. And that could be compulsive gambling. So my favorite moment was definitely getting to see that and the feeling that it kind of that it brought up within me of looking at, you know, something that was so huge within my life for so long that addiction made me completely disregard. Made me completely not care about, made me completely just only care about getting and using and finding ways and means to get more. And I don't feel shame about it anymore. I feel sadness, I don't feel regret because I know that everything that has happened in my life had to have added up to where I am right now. So if I regretted how that situation happened, I probably wouldn't. If I could change it, that would mean I'm not sitting where I am right now. And I truly believe that where I'm sitting at right now is exactly where I'm supposed to be. And it's, you know, living my best possible life. So it was definitely an interesting thing, and it was exciting. And I found myself reading a lot more poker blogs since then. So, you know, lost dreams reawakened, you know, or lost dreams awakened. I guess they wouldn't be reawakened if they're already awake. Okay, yeah. Misquoted literature there. My bad.
That part.
So it's time to get into our next segment. You know what time it is?
It's time to Ask an Addict with your host, Matthew M.
That is right. It is time to Ask an Addict. This is the segment of the show where we answer questions that have been submitted from listeners or viewers. And these can be anything you desire. It doesn't have to be recovery related. It can happily be recovery related. But whatever you want to ask, I will answer. This is definitely the part of the show that is a lot of opinion. Still experience strength and hope, but a lot of my opinion. So if you're interested in submitting a question, please send it to Matthew@cleanandfilthypodcast.com or go ahead and subscribe to all of the social medias and please submit it on one of them. And we very well might answer it here on air. Again, this is an opportunity to just kind of explain things that have worked within my recovery and things that I feel some kind of way about. So again, we are not coming from any perspective of any, you know, affiliation to anything. This is not what any fellowship says. This is just my experience, strength, and hope, and my opinion. So first question says, do we have to find a higher power, or can/should we ask our higher power to introduce him/her/them/itself to us? And this is an interesting thing because this is so subjective to anybody who's, you know, approaching the second step and is approaching this concept of a higher power. And it can be so different for, you know, so many people. You know, for me personally, I wasn't so much asking as much as I was just acting as if, you know, as I talked about before. I was just putting it out there. So in a way, I kind of was allowing my higher power to find me by acting as if. You know, so I don't feel that there's a set any specific way. That's a beautiful thing of finding a higher power of our own understanding, is that it doesn't have to be any specific way. It doesn't have to be getting on your knees before bed and, you know, doing a specific something. Because whatever works, works. And if something doesn't work, try something else. Try something else until we find something that does work. So that's what I love about this process, is that if we have the ability to, you know, allow our higher power to find us, we should do that. But the only constraint that I have on that is when it comes to a time perspective. Because if we've worked the first step and then we're like, all right, well, I'm not starting a second step until, you know, I get this burning bush moment and my higher power finds me, then that can cause some complacency. That can cause some procrastination. And that might be a subconscious way of procrastination. But I think it's very helpful and healthy to try different things and see what works. You know, and try something and see, wow, is my higher power, you know, revealing itself to me in this way? And for me, that is essentially what happened. You know, I acted as if I put something out there in the universe. I said a specific set of words. I wasn't okay with the word prayer at that point. So I said a specific set of words, and eventually things felt better. Things felt connected. Things felt a level of serenity. So I feel like my higher power presented itself to me. And again, within the wording of that, we don't need to label what our higher power is. You know, whether it's him, her, them, itself, whatever. Because as we talked about in the second step, shameless plug, if you haven't watched the second step, please go download. It's in episode 2 of the Queen and Filthy podcast. But within that, We don't need to understand or quantify or classify what our higher power is. Because if it works for us, then it works for us. And if it presents itself to us, then beautiful. But if it doesn't, then we might have to put some action into it to actually search for something that works for us so that we don't become stagnant or sitting there or thinking, well, I'm just waiting. I'm just waiting for it to happen. It's got to happen. When it might require more action. So to answer the question, if it works for you, cool. If it doesn't, try something else. Keep what works. Try something else. Leave the rest. So, all right. Next question says, what was my biggest discovery when doing my fourth step? Wow. A lot.
That part.
That was, I don't even know where to start on that, honestly. There were so many things, but I think the most important thing for me was realizing the self, like the patterns in my life. And it's funny, there's a line in the literature that says, like, realizing self-defeating patterns that have prevailed in my life. And then, like, the serenity that you get from needing to change them. And that was so my story. Because there were so many patterns that had occurred throughout my active addiction and throughout my life, even prior to using, that I had never looked at and damn sure never taken responsibility for. And the ability to take that responsibility and realize that even in situations that I wanted to pretend I didn't have anything to do with, I actually did, that led so beautifully to seeing those patterns that then I could really look at and look at the character defects that were within those patterns and then really address those on the sixth step. Like that was probably the biggest thing, was being able to actually see the patterns in all aspects of my life, all aspects, all those categories I read earlier about the fourth step. Yeah, there were patterns of the same thing in every single one of them. And then being able to take responsibility for that, to not, you know, play the manipulation, the self-manipulation of, oh, this wasn't my fault, somebody did this to me, and being able to look at that I would say was the biggest discovery that I had within my fourth step, was the amount of patterns and lack of responsibility I'd taken in my life. That was probably the big thing there. All right, next thing we're going to talk about says, why do we suggest not getting in a relationship / making any life-changing decisions for the first year? Now, this is going to be a topic that we're going to discuss a lot more later on. But this is something that I've been asked a ton of times because it's such a prevalent thing within recovery. You know, you see people who come into the rooms and are super about their recovery and then link up with some other brand newcomer, and then you stop seeing them again. If I had a dollar for every single time I have seen it in my last 3 years in the program, I would have probably $35. Yeah, definitely not enough for a down payment on a Lamborghini, but more than I have in my hand right now from not getting that dollar. It just happens. It happens because we're so broken when we walk into the rooms that we attract broken. And two sickies don't make a welly. But oh, wow, we feel like it. Oh, we feel like, oh, I've got a little clarity. I've got 90 days. I've got more time than I've ever had. And that's beautiful. Congratulations on that time. But just because you're further along than you ever have does not mean you are ready to take on the emotional elements of a relationship, of quitting a job, of getting somebody pregnant, all these things that are massive things that can cripple our recovery because we're not used to those feelings. We're not used to the feelings of love or emotion. We aren't used to feelings. We don't know how to identify feelings. We damn sure don't know how to react or respond to feelings. And even if we can identify it, we're probably going to react in a negative way. That's what we do when we're so broken. When we're so broken and we don't have this crutch of drug use, We want to look at other ways that we can feel it. So I'm gonna get in a relationship. And oftentimes what I'll see is especially people who aren't doing the program. They aren't doing step work. They still feel that void inside. And I'll admit that was the same for me. That was the same for me. Before I my first sponsor that I had wouldn't let me start step work until I got 90 days clean. So I ended up getting a new sponsor. And in those 90 days, I felt so empty, I reverted to things that I had done in the past that had made me feel a little better. Whether it was sex, whether it was attention seeking, whether it was, you know, self-serving things, whether it was just eating like shit, watching too much porn, all these things that I did to make me feel a little bit better because I felt that emptiness. But the beautiful thing is once I started working some steps, that emptiness went away. Or maybe it got a little bit smaller. And that hole in my soul got a little filled. That's why it says at the end of the first step that once we've worked the first step, we are left with a vacuum inside of us that we got to find something to fill. And that's why we develop a relationship with our higher power. That's why it's so important. That's why a second step is vital after you've worked the first step. Because if not, if we sit there after we've broken down who we are on a first step, and then you're like, okay, well, I'm not working on the second step yet, but oh, hey, she smiled at me. Yo, let's fill it up. Fill up that hole. Oh, she's trying to fuck? Oh, fill up that hole. That's what we do. And that's why we say it's so important not to get in a relationship. Because inevitably, when the relationship goes south, and again, I'm not saying it's going to happen, but I'm just going off of my experience, strength, and hope when it comes to numbers here. The number of relationships, rehab romances, that I've seen actually pan out for more than a year without it having catastrophic type of results, meaning relapse, meaning death, meaning jail, is probably 3%. That was an arbitrary number. I'll admit that. I pulled that out of my ass. But that was probably what I would say. Because we need to work on ourselves. And inevitably, if one of the people is actually working on themselves and the other one isn't, then guess what? You're becoming well. They're still sick. That doesn't work. Most of the time, the sick element is going to drag the well element back. And that is just something we don't need to worry about in early recovery. We already have so many other things that we have to deal with on a day-to-day basis to live life on life's terms, to add another element. It's not necessary. And the biggest thing I can say is, for me personally, the human being in recovery that I was with 30 days is nothing compared to the human being I was with 90 days. And I thought, oh my God, the amount of change in those 60 days, I thought I was, whew, it couldn't get better than this. Guess what? It did. And the human being I was at a year and a half or 2.5 isn't anything comparable to where I was thinking I was so woke and blessed and amazing at 90 days. Because the longer we stay in this process, the more that we grow. And the more that we grow, the more we realize that if we would have stopped growing at 60 days, we would have cheated ourselves. And very often, getting in a relationship cheats us. Because we focus everything that we had been focusing on our recovery onto that other person. And those feelings that come up that we're just now starting to learn how to identify a feeling. And now I'm having to not react to them. Now I'm having to not explode on them. That's just that's not possible for most of us. I think when we come into the rooms, that's not possible. We don't know how to not do that. And I was one of those people. When with you know, 2 months, I would get a I would get a message from a certain person, and I would go 0 to 100, anger, rage, smashing my steering wheel until I broke it, because I didn't know how to work through it. I didn't know what to do with that feeling. All I knew how to do was the unhealthy thing. But the longer that we stay in the process, when those situations occur, I'm not saying that they don't lead to a feeling of anger or rage, but it's no longer a lightning fast elevator. Before, it was like taking the elevator at the Burj Khalifa Hotel from like the lobby to 181 stories up like that. Now it's like riding up a roller coaster, just a click, 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 click. It might still get me up to that level, but it doesn't have to. Because now that I have spiritual principles and I'm able to be more centered and I have less of a hole in my soul, I'm able to work through things healthily. And it's just, it's such a sad thing when I see somebody who is so about their recovery, so about their recovery, and then gets in a relationship or gets a new job or gets something else that they just don't care about recovery anymore. And I get it. Like, we're in recovery to grow and build better lives. But if we don't keep our recovery first, when life on life terms happens, which it will, we don't have that safety net to fall back on. And using becomes a lot more possible of a scenario because that's what we knew how to do for so long. And if we're not doing the work within our step work and within our recovery to actually build those additional tools, it always seems like the easier option. So that's why. Because it's not going to work. And I'm sorry if you're sitting out there with like 60 days and you and your dude or your girl from treatment are like confessing that you're going to be together forever. I hope it works. But please don't sacrifice recovery for that feeling that is trying to fill what we have inside. So we're going to talk about this a lot more because it's something that happens so often. And it's just, it sucks. It sucks like seeing somebody who was so about it and then just, I never hear from them again. And that's happened with many of my sponsees to where, you know, even if I suggest, hey, don't do that. Sometimes, you know, people don't take the suggestions. Fact of life. So we have a couple more questions. We're going to get to them next week because we are already at 6:15. But before we close up for the day, we got to get to them Queen Time shout-outs. That's right. So this is the time on the program where we want to recognize people within recovery who have hit a milestone. This can be one of the universally recognized milestones, which is newcomer, which is 0 to 29 days, 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, 6 months, 9 months, 1 year, 18 months, or multiple years. But we want to make sure we give extra shout-outs. So we also recognize big numbers, 100 days, 500 days, 1,000 days, 5,000, 10,000. So if you have a celebration of your time that has occurred between now and the next week's episode on Tuesday, please send me an email. Again, Matthew@cleanandfilthypodcast.com so that you can get your name on here and we can give you a shout-out on air. So make sure to send your name, how much time you're celebrating, and we'll get you a shout out. So, first up, celebrating 30 days, we've got Ashley. Great job. Next up, with 90 days, we got Mikey from the Bronx. And then we got Becca celebrating 1 year clean. Well done, Becca. Whole time in the pandemic, well done. Next up, we got my man, Mustang Daniel, with them 2 years. And then we got Molly, known her since the jump, taking 3 years clean. Boop, boop, boop. And then finally, we've got Tracy, homegirl I've known well before pretty much during my active addiction. And then what do you know? We both end up in recovery. So congratulations on 5 years. Boop, 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 boop. And that's what we do. Anybody who doesn't realize, we do the boop, boops for each year that you have clean. So that's what we do. So again, shout out to everybody who picked up time today. If you didn't pick up time today, keep coming back, and you will. That's literally how it works. So again, if you have a clean time shout out coming up, make sure to send it over, and we'll get you up on our next podcast. So it's about that time. Huge thank you to everybody for hanging out with us today. Great episode. Love each and every one of you. And again, a huge shout out to our episode sponsors, Etc. by Emily and Metaphysical Minds, and also to our amazing theme music, Anything by Alice in Wonderland and Valentino Khan. To download that song, it's in the description below. Please go ahead, like, comment, subscribe. Make sure to go and download the podcast so we can grow up and up and up. And guess what? See you guys next week. Love you all. I'm just gonna